in the next few minutes, hopefully it'll be clear to you sort of what we'll be doing over the next 2 days in the standard model lectures. But first, we have a pretty broad spectrum of people in terms of the way you're approaching physics and the kinds of problems you're going to solve. So this is a gross generalization, but I think it's helpful to come at this from the sort of perspective of theorists and experimentalists. So, okay, what does the standard model do to a theorist? It's a quantum field theory, right? It's a bunch of equations, a bunch of fields, and a bunch of parameters and a Lagrangian that tells us how these fields interact with one another. Okay? And this is the language that we can use to specify what we mean by the theory, and then do calculations, in the case of standard model, in many cases, to very high levels of precision. Right? And so, all of the stuff we're doing as theorists are these kind of idealized perspective of, okay, I have this particular sandbox and we're playing within it. Okay. And we'll talk about most of the different aspects of the standard model. I took this from Wikipedia, but they're actually missing a term, so I added it to it. If you can see, one of them is more clear than the others. Okay. Whereas if you come at it from an experimental perspective, what is a standard model? It's a lot of measurements of properties of particles. So this is a plot showing, it's about a year old, from the ATLAS experiment, because we're in Canada, and that's what you do when you're in Canada. And also we have deputy spokesperson here. So all of the different types of particles you can produce in the standard model on the x-axis and cross-sections on the y-axis. And it's pretty amazing. You can see that the cross-sections span something like 14 orders of magnitude. The points are the experimental measurements, and the little bars are the theoretical prediction. Is that true? No, sorry. The gray is the theoretical prediction. The point is the central value of the experiment, and the colored bar is the experiment uncertainty. You can see that in almost every case, they're overlapping with one another. Okay? But from an experimentalist perspective, we're interested in observables, things like rates, masses, decay widths, something tangible that you can measure. And so, of course, the challenge is that we're trying to bring these two perspectives together. And so theorists are trying to calculate quantities that are of interest to experimentalists that can be used to test the model. And I should point out that this is only a small subset of the thousands of measurements, because in addition to total cross-section measurements, there are measurements of angular distributions and distributions in energy, and all of these are things that we can extract from the theory. Okay. So if we summarize kind of in one slide, how, when we put together the Lagrangian and try to describe it in terms of experimentally accessible things, we have this table of particles. Of course, we have the gauge bosons, which mediate the forces. We have collections of fermions, the quarks and leptons. We have a Higgs boson. And if we count up all of the free parameters in that Lagrangian that I started with, there are 24, I believe. So maybe 23, actually. Yeah. Depending on whether you count the cosmological constant or not. So these are the ones, again, from Wikipedia. You can parameterize them in many different ways, but they're typically particle masses, particle mixing angles, coupling constants, and then the ones that were not included on Wikipedia that I added here are the neutrino mixing parameters. And so what's really spectacular is that this is a very overconstrained system, right? We have a theory that has 20 some odd parameters, and we can calculate thousands of things, and all of them agree with the experiment. Okay, so that tells us that A, our theory is doing a really good job of describing the experiment, but that this theory has to be structured in a very particular way in order to be able to explain this vastness. Okay, so one of the goals of these lectures is to explore the why. Why is it that the standard model has to have the structure that it does, so that we can explain this huge range of parameters? And then hopefully this will set us up for all of the other lectures, especially when we start going beyond the standard model, for, we need to understand what we know before we can start to explore what we don't know. So if we're asking, why? Why is the standard model the way it is? I would say that there are kind of two categories. One of them of questions we can ask are what you might call just so questions. Things like, why is the electron mass the way it is? Why is the strong interaction coupling the way it is? Why are there three generations of fermions? Okay, and these are things that in theories beyond the standard model might have a dynamical explanation, but in the context of our current theory, it's like, that's just what it is, okay? There's no explanation. These are the inputs to the theory. So the why questions I want to focus on are things that are really rooted in why the theory has to have the structure that it does, and they're rooted in empirical observations as well as physical constraints on the theory. And the real must-haves that we need are causality. I really don't want to end up in some horrible time loop grandfather paradox situation. And so in the context of the vast majority of theories, this includes you want a local theory and a theory that's Lorentz invariant. Okay. We're at perimeter, so probably there are some people that try to throw these things away. So I don't want to say that that's, you know, not something you can do. But in the vast majority of cases, that's, these are assumptions that we make in order to preserve this. And also unitarity. This is a quantum mechanical theory. And of course, maybe quantum mechanics is wrong, but most of us probably think it's right. And so we want our probabilities to add up to one. And if we impose these, then we get consequences that drive the structure of the theory. For example, the requirement that we need to have charge conservation engaged invariance, that we need to have a Higgs mechanism, how the different fields are interacting. We can't just write down any arbitrary thing, because if we do, that's going to break some of these principles that we want. And so we're going to kind of go through systematically. And some of these consequences might tie into this. For example, we can't explain why there are three fermion generations, but we can explain, once you accept that there are three lepton generations, why there have to be three quark generations from these. So there are various ways that we can take the empirical observations and put them together into like a minimal structure that both satisfies these requirements and meets the experimental requirements. And either it's a success or a failure, but or you know, frustrating, but the standard model seems to fit the bill as this minimal picture. So we'll get into specifics shortly, but just to give you a sense of where we're going, today I want to focus on what I think is the heart of the problems with giving masses to particles and why we need to have a structured standard model that we do, namely, what happens when you give masses to spin one particles and what goes wrong if you just kind of do it willy-nilly. And that leads us towards an understanding of the Higgs mechanism that we'll explore in the context of a simpler model that allows us to unpack some of the physics. Tomorrow, we'll talk about the electroweak theory, which is kind of the main central point of the standard model. Again, how you can go from empirical observations to the structure that we have and what we expect interactions to do. Tomorrow and Wednesday, we'll talk about tests of the theory. And for instance, the high energy behavior of the theory, how we know that this is self-consistent, as well as some connections to QCD. I can't talk about everything in 4 days, so QCD is maybe not going to have the role that it maybe deserves. But that's just in the interest of covering, you know, some topics properly. And then on Thursday, I'll spend time talking about neutrinos and use that also as an entryway to talking about flavor physics. Okay. Before we kick off, does anyone have any questions? We really, really encourage people to ask questions. Feel free to interrupt at any time. Yes?
Why locality is a must?
Why is locality a must? I mean, I think it's just the fact that, you know, I want to be able to describe interactions in terms of events where, you know, when I change reference frames, if I build my stories in terms of events, then, you know, causality preserves time-like separations. Whereas if I have, you know, some notion of simultaneity, I want something happening at the same time across two points, then I end up introducing things outside of the light cone that influence one another. So
locality is a consequence of causality.
Yes, yes. So I'm so, you know, Steven Weinberg in his quantum theory of fields books, I think does, it's really technical, but does a very systematic job of trying to lay out, you know, when you try to construct an arbitrary theory, you find that it will violate locality, and in particular this thing called the cluster decomposition principle. And this pushes you towards theories that involve fields where you have creation annihilation operators. So we're not going to go through that story, but if you're interested, you can look in like chapters 2 and 3 and 4 of Weinberg's field theory book. Is there someone on Zoom who can mute themselves?
It's having a problem too.
I'm locked out, so I can't do anything. I guess I misbehaved. That's I can't. Oh, great! Thank you for muting yourself. Other questions before we get going. Exciting. Okay. Like I said, because we have such a broad range of people here, some of the things you hear might be like boring. I know that some of it might be a new spin on something you've already heard. Some of it might be totally new. For every one of you, you should feel free to chime in with questions, interrupt at any time. Because this is really meant for you, not for me to just like impress you all with my knowledge of the standard model. And I'm sure the same goes for every other lecture. So we will put this away. I don't know how to make the screen go up. Cliff told me I should just say I want the screen up and somebody's listening to me and we'll do that. Is that true?
There's
it's the deus ex machina, right?
It's not amazing. It's just like, is there actually a person doing this or is it just AI? I think I'm skeptical. Okay. Nice. Okay. Okay. There's a person there. Cool. Okay. So, point of this first day is to hopefully convince you that we really need a Higgs mechanism. And you know, if, whether you're just talking to your grandparent who heard about the Higgs boson in the news, or you know, somebody who's a physicist but maybe not in our field, the natural question is, you say, well, you need the Higgs boson to give mass to particles. And the natural answer is like, why? Why can't a particle just have mass, right? That's something we can give to it. That's what we want to talk about, okay? And so in order to see why we need a Higgs, we need to basically see what goes wrong. And really, the focus is on spin one particles, because these are the ones that if you just give them masses in an arbitrary way, you can run into problems. And it really comes from when we consider the sort of effects of relativity and spin kind of together that push us into a bind where it's not so simple to give masses to particles. Okay. So let's start with a more familiar example. Which is a photon. And just because you probably didn't believe me when I said I want you to put your hand up, I'm going to ask you some easy questions. Tell me things you know about a photon.
Spin one.
Spin one, cool. OK, yes, great. It's a spin one particle. It is massless, OK. Anything else?
Two polarization states.
Two polarization states. Anything else? Pardon me?
Unbroken symmetry.
Unbroken, so there's some gauge invariance associated with it. Okay.
They're fast.
They're fast. How fast do they go? This is why I teach my first year students. Oh my goodness, okay. They go at speed one because we're natural units where the seed is. Okay, so they have these properties associated with them. And what we'll see is that these things here are all kind of connected to one another. Let's unpack this two polarization states. These polarization states are transverse. Okay? You derive this all in intro E&M, where if I have a photon going in some k direction, the electric field can oscillate in any direction that's perpendicular to that, which is the direction of the polarization. So from this list, how is it that we can unambiguously define the notion of transverse, right? When I say that they're only transverse polarizations, like what aspect of these photons makes it so that we can tell what counts as transverse?
Mm-hmm. Well, the electromagnetic fields and the electric field and the magnetic field are both perpendicular to the momentum.
Okay, so they're both perpendicular to the momentum, but how do I know I can always unambiguously define transverse? There's a hand up.
Gauge invariance.
So gauge invariance, okay, this is related. You're going to say the same thing?
Divergence A.
Yeah.
Oh, is it like the group representation that you can, you know, if you do the group representation, you only mm-hmm. get the transverse mm-hmm. the transverse states, like you don't get the longitudinal states.
So this is all true. I think you're thinking very complicated. This again, let's think about if I was talking to my first year undergraduate students. What property of the photon means I can always unambiguously define transverse?
Because it's
it's always moving, right? It's always going at some speed. So I can always define a direction that's perpendicular to that, right? And all the things you're saying are right. When we unpack the mathematics of how, you know, the representations, the Lorentz group, and I try to have a massless state, and we're not going to go through that full in detail. But physically, well, it's always moving at C, and I can do Lorentz transformation, say, along this direction, but it's still moving in that direction, and I can define that, okay? So this is why we can define transverse polarizations, right? So if I define my polarization vector by some epsilon, we can say that epsilon dot k is 0. Okay. So now let's consider m not equal to 0. So the thing that's different is that it's not always going at c. And in fact, you can go into its rest frame. Okay, so let's say I do, you know, let's say this particle secretly has a mass m, small mass m. So Lorentz transformations don't affect the transverse polarization, so I still have those. Okay, let's say, I don't know, epsilon x and epsilon y, whatever. But now in the rest frame, we can use the fact that my theory is isotropic, right? And so that tells me that there actually has to be a third polarization. So that's fine. And actually, this is what you would expect from non-relativistic quantum mechanics, right? When I say how many spin states does a spin one particle have, there are three, right? Plus, minus one in the projection along the quantization axis and zero, right? So this is maybe more we would expect. This is the surprising one, okay? But this leads to a conflict, namely that I expect that the V, you know, close to C limit of M equals zero theory should recover, you know, turn into an M goes to zero theory, right? This is the whole idea of relativity. If something's going really fast, I would naively expect to achieve that. But there's a mismatch, right? There's three polarizations, 3 degrees of freedom for a massless spin one particle, and 2 polarizations for a massless spin one particle. So you can't just give a mass and expect that when you go into the high energy limit, it's going to give you the same thing as you might expect for electromagnetism. Okay. And in fact, this is exactly what we see, that if you take a massive spin one particle and go into the E much, much bigger than M limit, things go wrong. And we'll unpack exactly what that means. But essentially, this third polarization, which doesn't really want to be there, causes unphysical, problematic behavior. Yes?
Question. Isn't that the same problem that you would have with a photon if we consider the temperature? It has mass, a plasma, and then you go to the limit where you just lose a degree of freedom.
So I guess I would say that remember that the photon in a plasma is a quasi-particle, right? So it's an excitation of the plasma that includes the electromagnetic field. So it's not like a fundamental degree of freedom. So it's not as big of a problem there, right? Because if I wanted to, I could write it in terms of the massless degree of freedom, and you know, you get that effective description of summing over a bunch of interactions. Yeah. And as we'll see, you certainly can have a massive spin one particle because we see them in nature, the W boson, the Z boson. In fact, the photon could have a mass. The photon might have a very small mass, but you know, I think the limit is something like 10 to the minus 27 electron volts. But you know, in experiment, you can never say something is exactly zero, right? There's always going to be some error bars. But we have to be careful with how we construct the mass so that we don't end up with inconsistency, is maybe one way of putting it. Yes?
This is a logistical question. Is there any way we can access the lecture notes?
I'm happy to post my own notes as long as you take them with a grain of salt. There might be typos and stuff. Yeah, we can. Presumably, I'll ask the head honcho.
We'll figure out how to get a web link to that so we can.
Yeah, because I mean, there's an Indico page, so presumably there's a way to upload things there.
Thank you.
Hallelujah.
This is useful as I snuck a peek at some of the previous Pearsa lectures from summer schools in the past. So there's actually a lot of these things that are out there. Okay. So let's try and go into some more technical detail and how this works. Okay. So let's start looking at, you know, photons engage invariants, because it's always helpful to start with a more familiar example and see how we end up with the two polarizations, remind ourselves of that, and then we can see what's different. Okay. So we use the potential formalism. Hopefully, the scalar and vector potentials are familiar to you, for instance, from undergraduate E&M. Actually, I want to write this as one of these. Okay. And you know, hopefully, you've also all seen four-vector notation and Einstein summation convention, although obviously, if you have questions about anything, you can feel free to unpack that. Okay. And the electromagnetic fields come from derivatives of A. So in particular, we have this electromagnetic field strength tensor, which is an anti-symmetric combination of derivatives. And basically, it just as a quick reminder, it maps to a tensor where I have the electric field here. And it has a property of anti-symmetry, so the upper entries are just the negatives of the lower entries. Okay, and this anti-symmetry is just manifested if I flip the indices around, we get that minus sign. Okay. And the Lagrangian, sorry, let's move this up. This is the familiar QED Lagrangian. New. So from that, we can derive the equations of motion, which are just Maxwell's equations written in covariant form. Okay, where this J is the for current. And this summarizes, you know, Maxwell's equations are derivatives of the E and B field, so that's going to be second derivatives of these potentials. Okay. So let's put in our definition of the field strength tensor. Okay, and when we do that, we're going to end up with two terms. One that's like the derivative indices contracted with one another. And the second is this other one. Okay. So this is just the Lorentz invariant version of the derivative, the Laplacian operator. This is going to be d squared a, I'm missing an index here, squared a nu. Okay. So this is the piece that looks like the wave equation, right? If you were to write down the wave equation for a classical electromagnetic field, that's the piece that you would get. Then you have this annoying other term, and that's going to be proportional to your source.
Okay. Using minus plus 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 or plus plus?
I'm using plus minus minus. Sorry.
If Clifford didn't know that.
I know.
There's always one that sneaks.
Do we want our masses to mass squared to be positive or negative, Cliff? How do you? Anyway, yeah, yes.
Yeah, so I think in the EM tensor, in the magnetic fields, are the signs flipped or something, like for the B factor? So it's like.
Are the signs flipped?
Yeah, like minus.
Potentially. I mean, there's the kind of covariant, contravariant versions of this, which will adjust the minus signs. So I.
Yeah, but you're changing for two like space indices regardless, so that doesn't. Yeah.
That's true. So dx ay. Well, dx ay minus dy ax will give me bz, right? Because that's the curl of a. I think that's right. Yeah, and then the minus sign comes from a cross product. Yeah. Anyway, I would not get hung up on that. I think the important thing for our purposes, because of course we don't really deal directly with the electromagnetic fields, so. Okay, so this is like the whirlwind tour of classical electromagnetism. Okay, and then this, if I have some source, basically what we're trying to do is solve for the A that gives rise to this source. And this is the differential equation we have to solve. And it would just be the wave equation, except for the fact that there's this term here, which is annoying. Okay, so this is where we can use the fact that there is gauge invariance in the theory. So let's remind ourselves of what gauge invariance looks like in this notation. So we can perform a gauge transformation where I change A to the derivative of some function, some differentiable function, okay, which is generally going to be a function of position. And if I take my field strength tensor, this is going to shift to d mu a nu plus d nu lambda. minus d nu a mu plus d mu lambda. You can see that these second derivative terms, because the partial derivatives commute, just cancel. And I'll get back the same field strength tensor that I had before. And so this tells me that my equation of motion is invariant. And also my Lagrangian is invariant under a gauge transformation. And in retrospect, this might not be surprising because my four vector for the potential has four components to it, but there are only two polarizations for the photon. So there's too much information contained in that A mu to be physical. What the gauge transformation does is it takes that out, right? It's important to note that a gauge invariance, even though we often use the language of gauge symmetry, it's not a symmetry of the system. I'm not performing a physical change to it. It's a redundancy in the description that's associated with the mathematical description of the four vector. Questions about any of this so far? Hopefully this is, you've seen this before, but I thought it was worthwhile to get us all on the same page. Yes?
That transformation takes 1 degree of freedom or two? It's just one.
One. Yes.
You still have another.
Yes, but that constraint actually comes from the differential equation that relates the, for instance, you can imagine that the like scalar potential is determined by the source. So yeah, we'll get to that momentarily. Yeah.
Your Lagrangian include the source, the other J in your equations.
It would if I coupled it to something. So yeah, this is just the Lagrangian for free. So I would have some A mu, J mu, yes.
And is that term invariant from the, what it is?
If you write it in that language, then what you find is that it changes up to a total derivative. And since then, when I integrate over in the action, I get something that is the same. Yeah. When I write it out in a fully gauge invariant way, like I actually write all of the fields, and the fields also transform under the gauge transformation, then the Lagrangian is invariant under the gauge transformation. Yeah. The reason why I'm being a bit sloppy about this is that usually what we do in quantum field theory is, you know, for instance, the Feynman rules are constructed for with the source-free like Green's functions. And so what we care most about is the propagation where J equals zero, and then we add those interactions in perturbation theory as interactions in the quantum field theory. Great, okay. So what is the use of this? So the use of this is that we can choose a gauge, which basically means picking a lambda that allows me to do what I want to. So the conventional gauge that we're going to choose, well, maybe first I'll just write explicitly that we're now going to consider the source-free limit. So this describes the free propagation of photons. Right. So when we do that, then we can choose a gauge. I mean, we can always choose a gauge, but we'll see that that choice actually allows us to eliminate two things. Okay, so one of them is what we call Coulomb gauge. And Coulomb gauge is the gauge where the divergence of the vector potential, so this is the spatial divergence of the vector potential, is zero. Okay. And in Coulomb gauge, Coulomb's law always applies. So even though you might have sources that are changing far away from where your field is, you have the scalar potential obeying Coulomb's law. Okay. And we can always choose this gauge. You can show that if you start with an A that doesn't satisfy this, you can perform a gauge transformation. You get a differential equation that has a solution to it, and so you know that this is a change that you can always make. Okay. If we combine this with the J equals zero, then we find that it is also true that the four divergence of A is zero. So this on its own is called Lorentz gauge, and in the source-free limit, these are the same. So these are two properties that we can have. And so when we go into this gauge, we get a very simple equation of motion which is just the wave equation in free space for each component of the vector potential. And in particular, if the spatial divergence of this is zero, you can show that the zeroth component is zero. So let's now look at the solution to this. This is a wave equation. So the solutions are going to be like a mu is going to be some polarization vector, which generally depends on the momentum k of the photon, e to the minus ik dot x, where this is the Lorentz invariant quantity. And our gauge conditions lead to k dot epsilon equals 0, and epsilon 0 equals 0. Okay. So the combination of gauge invariance with the equation of motion allows us to write the photon solutions as plane waves, where this polarization vector satisfies the transverse condition and has no zero component associated with it. So there are exactly two physical polarizations that are given by this. Questions? OK. So what does this actually look like for a particular photon? So for instance, if the momentum is k mu, here, so a common one might be that it's going purely in the z direction. So because it's massless, the energy is equal to the magnitude of the momentum. Then our two polarizations, or a particular basis for those, might be polarization point in the x direction, polarization point in the y direction. And those are going to be the transverse polarizations that we've already talked about. There's one other thing that we get from gauge invariance, which is this: in this theory, charge is also conserved. So if we momentarily reintroduce the J nu, I have this differential equation d mu, mu nu equals J nu. I can take the derivative of both sides with respect to nu. This is the divergence of the current. So this tells me something about, if I were to expand it out, I have d rho dt minus the divergence of the actual vector current. That's telling me what the actual charge creation rate is in some region of space. And this combination is 0 because I have an anti-symmetric tensor contracted with symmetric 1. So the partial derivatives commute with one another. So with a couple of lines of algebra, you can show that this thing is 0. So the fact that our equation of motion was built out of this gauge invariant object, the gauge invariant object was anti-symmetric, implies charge conservation. So we kind of have this. Yes?
So could you just quickly say how you get the Lorentz gauge from the Coulomb gauge?
How you get Lorentz gauge from Coulomb gauge. So basically where it comes from is that in the absence of sources, if you impose Coulomb gauge, then let me remember how this works. I think you end up, for the scalar potential, just getting Poisson's equation with no source, and that the solution is that there's zero scalar potential. And so and then once you put that in, combining it with the Coulomb gauge condition, you get Lorentz gauge. Just because if I expand it out, I find that.
Is there any reason not to just impose Lorentz directly?
So they're different if the current is non-zero, but if the current's zero, they're equivalent. Yeah, that one follows from the other. So basically it comes from the fact that d mu a mu is d0 a zero minus this. This is zero in Coulomb gauge, and if this is zero, then they're related directly to one another. And of course, if you put the J in, you still always get two polarizations, but it becomes a little bit more complicated, right? Because instead of having Lorentz gauge and Coulomb gauge come together, you've got some complicated constraint, but you still always get two polarizations. Okay, so the takeaway, hopefully, from all of this is that we have a connection between gauge invariants, two polarizations, current conservation or charge conservation, and the masslessness, because as we'll see momentarily, if I add a mass to this theory, then it's no longer gauge invariant. So these things kind of come as a bundle, and it's important that we have each of these ingredients.
Sorry, one question. The gauge invariance, well, it implies two polarizations, but only on this gauge or in any other?
In any gauge, yeah. So because the physics is independent of the gauge, that's what gauge invariance tells us. If I pick a gauge and I show this in this gauge, then it has to be true in every other gauge. Different gauges might have different properties that are manifest. So often, you know, assuming you did your calculation correctly in that gauge, of course, then if the results you find from one can be applied to another. There's a separate question whether you did the calculation correctly. I did, because this is just out of a textbook. But you know, in an ideal world, you want to do the calculation in different gauges and make sure you've got the same answer as a cross-check. Okay. Before we move on to massive spin 1 particles, I think the last bit of information we need is, what does all of this have to do with particle physics? I mean, there's a photon, so that's nice. But this is all classical electromagnetism. So this is so far all classical. In the QFT, the photon, you know, the four vector is replaced by a four vector field. And this photon field has annihilation and creation operators, okay, that create and destroy photons. And the coefficients are these polarization vectors, right? So that's kind of how the classical solutions to the equation of motion map onto the quantum theory. It's probably familiar to you also from fermions. And when you solve the Dirac equation, what you get are the wave functions that are the amplitudes associated with creating and destroying states. Right, so these show up in, or I guess I should say the epsilon, show up in the quantum amplitudes. So for example, if I had a vector boson going into some, you know, FF bar, my matrix element is going to be proportional to the polarization. With some Lorentz structure that I'm going to be ambiguous about. Okay, and the point is that I get something that's like polarization four vector dotted into some amplitude that carries a vector index, right? So that I create a Lorentz invariant quantum amplitude, which is a requirement of special relativity. So all of this stuff, what's relevant about it is that, among other things, is that it shows up in amplitudes for physical processes. So my polarization solutions feed into the probability of producing certain polarizations of photons, for example. So you can go through some exercise in QED where if I have, you know, left chiral electrons and right chiral anti-electrons annihilating, you know, into mu plus mu minus, that there are certain polarizations that contribute and so on in the way that you expect. Yes?
That's a massive theory.
That's just a Feynman diagram and an amplitude. I mean, no one says that that amplitude is non-zero. I'm just showing you schematically. Yeah, so in the case of a massless particle, this would vanish, right? But in the case of a massive particle, it will not vanish. I didn't want to show a theory with two photons because then you have two polarizations. And yeah. There's nothing wrong with constructing this. It's just that it's zero. But you get the gist of how these polarizations couple in to the matrix elements. Other questions? Okay, after all of this talking, we can finally start talking about massive spin one particles. So let's do that.
Question.
Yeah.
Yeah, just a quick question. Just to make sure I'm correct. So here, if you would replace in a massless case, if you replace the polarization by a momentum, you would get zero. That's the Warren identity. Is that
yes, correct? That's correct. Yeah, and that's exactly because that mu is the current in that case, and d mu j mu is zero. So, yeah, and that's very important actually. Yeah, polarizations of massive spin one. Okay. So, we're just going to imagine a hypothetical world where we've given the photon a mass. Because if we talk about, say, Z bosons, we have to worry about non-abelian gauge theory. Okay. So now we expect, from the arguments that we had before, some third polarization, which is going to be the 0, 0, 0, 1 polarization, because I can go into the rest frame of the particle. The Lagrangian is similar, but now has a mass term. Our mass terms are quadratic terms involving the field. And these have derivatives, so these don't induce masses for particle, but I can add a mass term with something like this, okay? And this is not gauge invariant, right? If I shift a mu by some constant d mu lambda or some term, it's not going to give me the same thing that I had before. If I do the equation of motion for a free particle, I'm now going to get d mu d mu plus m a squared mu minus d mu d mu a mu equals 0. So this looks kind of like that one up there, but I have this extra mass term. Okay, and that's going to be the term that spoils gauge invariance. Now, it turns out that you can still get a Lorentz gauge-like condition. Oh, there's a board right here that I can use. So we're going to take the d nu of both sides. So I'm going to get d mu d mu plus ma squared d mu a nu d mu d mu a nu. I'm missing a d mu. And again, because partial derivatives commute, you can check that this term and this term cancel each other out. And what we're left with is a constant times this thing is equal to 0. So we actually have still the same Lorentz gauge-like thing, but this is now not associated with a gauge choice. This is just for manipulating the equation of motion. Okay. So this is related to earlier, there was a question about start with four components and how do you get down to two? Well, one of is the constraint associated with the equation of motion, and one is gauge invariance. Here, we're seeing the constraint associated with the equation of motion that takes us from four polarizations to three polarizations, but we're not going to have the extra gauge invariance that takes us down to two. So we can now substitute this back in, and what we're left with is d mu plus ma squared, a nu equals 0. Does anyone know what this equation is called? Have sort of wave equation-y thing plus m squared acting on the Klein-Gordon equation. Yeah. It's the Klein-Gordon equation. If you want, you can plug it in. You know, we do the same thing. It's a wave equation. I substitute in some a mu is epsilon mu, you know, minus ikx. Okay. So this is exactly the same as we had before. But we have no gauge condition. Okay, so it is no longer true. And I'll get to your question in a sec, that epsilon 0 equals 0. Yeah, there's a question.
Now we have four scalars. It's Klein-Gordon.
It's the same as the Klein-Gordon equation for each component of the gauge field. So I had that, those four scalars are 4 degrees of freedom. Of course, they're related to one another by Lorentz transformations. Yeah.
And there's a constraint, so you have three, right?
So you have three. So it's, yeah, exactly. It's no longer true that you have epsilon, but you still have three polarizations. Okay. And these correspond to the epsilon x, epsilon y, epsilon z, because in Canada I'm allowed to say that. Okay. My students won't complain to me. Okay. So let's see what the consequences of that are.
I have a question, because it seems like all of them do have epsilon 0 equals to 0. Where is that?
So that's so that is in one frame. So you're right that I can pick a frame. So that is a very astute observation. But before, epsilon 0 was equal to 0 in every frame. Now it there I can pick one frame, which is the rest frame of the particle, where we can argue from isotropy that I have the polarizations along the three directions. But now let's see what happens when we do a Lorentz transformation to another frame. And what we're going to see is that epsilon 0 is no longer 0. So I'm losing my chalks here. Let's bring this down for a sec. Does anyone know if there are more white chalk somewhere? Oh, there's like a huge box of it here. Cool. Okay, so we're going to start in the photon rest frame. So in this frame, k mu is going to be the mass 0, 0, 0. Okay, that's the four momentum. And I'm going to have what's called the longitudinal polarization, which is the polarization that points in the direction of the motion of the particle. Of course, in the rest frame, there's no such thing, but we're going to perform a Lorentz transformation along the z direction. Z. Z. Okay. And what we're going to find is, so now k vector in the prime frame is going to be like k z hat. And I'm going to get in this frame 1 over ma magnitude of k 0, 0, e, where in this case I'm being very careful to not use the ultra-relativistic approximation. So the point is that, remember, Lorentz transformations scramble spatial and time, spatial-like and time-like coordinates. So when I do a Lorentz transformation to a new frame, I get this. And this kind of energy over m factor is just the familiar gamma factor from special relativity. Okay. So, you know, just like you can do normal Lorentz transformations, I can make the momentum of anything be whatever I want it to be. Does anyone see a problem given sort of how we're assembling pieces and how these gauge bosons, or in this case, just spin one particle, interact with standard model fields, that I have this polarization that looks like this? Have like E over M times some stuff.
I mean, it blows up in the small mass limit.
It blows up in the small mass limit. Okay, so we can always ask, what's the physical consequence of that? The physical consequence is, remember that we dot these polarization vectors into our amplitude. So I'm going to get amplitudes that go like E over M, which blows up in the small mass limit. That's bad, right? Amplitudes tell me something about the probability, density of this. And what I have as I try to go to energies that are larger and larger is that my quantum amplitudes are blowing up, and they blow up in such a way that I can no longer preserve unitarity, okay? And in particular, the matrix elements for, say, scattering processes have to approach constant at high energy, or in other words, the cross-section has to go like 1 over the center of mass energy squared. So this is bad because it seems to violate unitarity in the E much bigger than M limit. Or rather, it violates perturbative unitarity, meaning if I calculate Feynman diagram to some fixed order, and I start dotting these in, if I'm not careful with how I dot these in, if I just dot them however I want, I'm going to get probabilities that it blow up and will no longer sum to 1, and that is very bad. Okay. So I think this is very important. You cannot have arbitrarily coupled longitudinal polarizations. Right, if I just couple them in some random way, I'm going to get these huge E over M's in, as I try to go to the high energy limit. This is specifically in the high energy limit. So the breakdown happens as we go to higher and higher energies. So this seems bad because we know there are massive spin 1 particles like Z boson, W boson, okay? And they have a longitudinal polarization, and we know that something goes wrong in the high energy limit. We'll pause and take questions. Yeah.
Yeah, actually, we know from EFT perspective that we got to add some extra terms, right, if we go to high energies. So they will never say this, right?
Yes, that's right. Because so the problem with the EFT is that, and we'll talk about this a little bit more, I think, on Wednesday. But you know, in the EFT, I try to separate my scales. I have my heavy physics and my light physics. This high energy limit tells me that my spin 1 particle has to be in the light, you know, the stuff that I keep, degrees of freedom I keep in my EFT. And then I get 1 over m spin 1 particle squared. That's not, the EFT always looks like 1 over some cutoff squared. So the terms that are higher order are never going to save me. And that actually has implications, for instance, for the strong interactions, where there are also massive spin 1 particles, like the rho meson, et cetera. Although there, when you go into the high energy limit, eventually they break apart. And so that kind of resolves the problem. Great question. Other questions? OK, so can we fix this? Hopefully we can. Otherwise, we should all just quit. OK, so a first thing you can imagine is, can I devise the, you know, basically this dot product so that the longitudinal polarizations decouple? Because then it's fine, right? I can have these individual terms in a 4 vector that don't mean anything on their own, that aren't dotted into anything, or dotted in such a way that I don't get this blowing up behavior, and then it's fine, right? Because then the norm of this polarization vector, in spite of the fact that these things blow up, is still minus 1, right? Because it's a Lorentz invariant quantity. So what we can do is note that when the energy is much bigger than MA, my longitudinal polarization vector looks a lot like my momentum 4 vector minus some other piece plus some corrections in the mass squared. So this basically is just k mu. All of my chalks have gone up here. So this is the piece that's bad. And this is the piece that is fine, right? Because I get m over heavy momentum scale. So if I can make it so that this part of the polarization vector does not contribute, and this part of the polarization vector does contribute, then we are good to go. And so in particular, if there were a principle of my theory such that you probably end up with chalk all over yourself when you do these things. So if theory were invariant under the transformation K goes to, I'm not going to get all the factors right if I don't know what me. Sorry, not K. Epsilon then we're okay. And it turns out that this is exactly what gauge invariance does. Okay, so if I choose my gauge function to be minus I over m e to the minus I kx, then when I do this, a mu goes to d mu lambda, then I subtract off this dangerous piece of the longitudinal polarization. So if I have gauge invariance, then these things, these longitudinal polarizations decouple. And this is precisely because they're coupling to a conserved current. The k mu dotted into the j mu is zero. So there's a bunch of different ways that you can see this. So that's cool. Yes?
So what do you exactly mean by arbitrarily coupling the longitudinal?
I guess what I mean is that it's, you know, this dot product has to be Lorentz invariant. So this mu has to transform like a four vector. But apart from that, I don't put any constraints on it. It's some number that depends on, you know, momenta and whatever of the theory. So, you know, maybe it depends on the momentum of one of the fermions and something like that. So if I just write down an arbitrary function that transforms like a four vector, this dot product will blow up. Okay. But if my m is such that the theory is invariant under shifts in the polarization such that I can cancel this piece out, then that longitudinal polarization doesn't couple. And that's essentially putting constraints on what this m mu matrix element is, that it can't just be any function. Yes?
Question. In that case, you've done the calculation in the rest frame.
And which calculation?
The amplitudes, like that E would be in the rest frame of the... What I mean is, if you do that in another frame or just use an expression with math,
So
have the same problem? Because if you set the mass to zero that you...
I understand what you're saying. Yeah, so I guess what I would say is that I was trying to cheat here by not putting multiple polarization vectors in. But if I have, for instance, a collision where I have FF bar go to two photons, then I have two photon polarizations. I can go into a frame where one of them is at rest, but in that frame, the other one is going to be moving. So in a general collision, I can't go into a frame where they're all at rest. And you're right, if I consider just this amplitude on its own, I can go to the rest frame of the gauge boson, and then I'm not in the E greater than M limit. But if I have a collision of two photons, I can't go into a frame where they're both at rest. Yeah, that's a great question. Maybe I should have just written down a more complicated amplitude, but you know, we'll see that later. Great. Okay, so this is great. All we need to do is add gauge invariance, okay, but what does gauge invariance require of the mass of my particle? So if I say, okay, well, let's just consider that my theory has this gauge invariance. Something zero. What's zero?
Yes.
What's zero? The mass of the particle being zero. So what we found is that the longitudinal polarizations decouple if there is a gauge invariance, but that gauge invariance also requires the mass to be zero. So that sucks. So what we want is a theory that has gauge invariants and that we can kind of pick up a mass, okay? But that mass cannot be embedded directly in the theory, that mass has to come from somewhere else. That ultimately comes from the mismatch of the degrees of freedom. That the spin one particle is going to borrow a degree of freedom from something else to pick up that third polarization, and that third polarization is going to couple in this way such that it's not dangerous. Okay? And that's basically what the standard model does. Okay, so let's start working through some details of how that works. So now we're going to start talking about the Higgs mechanism, which is just what I explained. And we're going to consider it in just this photon case for now. And then tomorrow we'll talk about it in the more complicated Higgs mechanism. And the kind of theory we've been talking about, gauge theory, is called an abelian theory. Okay, abelian basically means that the gauge transformations commute with one another, so that if I perform a gauge transformation and then another one, I could do them in either order and I would get the same thing. Okay. So we need to add a Higgs field, which is a complex scalar field. It has 2 degrees of freedom because it's a particle and antiparticle, and it's going to have a charge under this electromagnetism. And basically, we want this field to turn on in the vacuum, which is going to donate one of its degrees of freedom to the gauge field. Okay. For starters, just so that we're all on the same page, let's consider turning off the gauge interaction so they just have the theory of the scalar. And we want to know how we can get a field on at low energies. So my Lagrangian is going to be some kinetic term minus the potential. But I'm going to choose my potential to have what we call a global symmetry such that it's invariant under transformations where phi goes to some e to the I alpha phi, where this is just a constant. Okay, so in other words, I want my potential to be invariant under rephasing. Okay, and that's going to give us the property that we want. So in this theory, there is a conserved charge, but this charge doesn't couple to anything. It's like baryon number or lepton number. It's just something that's conserved. And the potential is such that the minimum is not at zero. I'm not going to do a really terrible job of drawing that, but I don't want to deal with getting the projector down. So here's my V. So basically, it has some ground state located not at the origin, and then it's kind of higher outside of that. Okay. So I have basically a ring of the potential, and then I have a ring where I'm in the vacuum. And I can write potentials like this as minus mu squared phi squared plus lambda over 4 phi to the fourth. And this is a negative mass squared, which just means that the minimum is not here. It's somewhere down here. And in quantum field theory, in order to get a physical theory, you need to expand around a stable minimum. So let's do that. Actually, I'm maybe in the interest of time not going to do that. I'm just going to tell you what the minimum is. So the minimum of potential has the expectation value of phi is root 2 mu squared over lambda. And this is defined as some quantity V over root 2, where V is essentially the strength of the field. You know, it's turned on. Hopefully, this is somewhat familiar to you, but if it's not, feel free to chime in with questions. So what we want to do is shift our field so that I pick some new field that has a minimum at big phi equals V over root 2. And the answer should be invariant under my parameterization, or the physics is. So let's shift phi in the following way. I'm going to find phi as 1 over root 2 v plus little phi of x e to the I pi of x over v. So there's two fields corresponding to the 2 degrees of freedom. And this has the property that the expectation value of the little phi is 0. Okay? So I'm shifting my field, so I'm expanding around that new minimum. And when I do that, I get the following Lagrangian. Minus, you know, v of phi, where v of phi is 1/2 lambda v squared over 2 phi squared plus 1/4 lambda v phi cubed plus 1 over 16 lambda phi to the fourth. And our masses are found by reading off the quadratic terms. So the squared mass of my little phi field is going to be lambda v squared over 2. And my mass of my pi field is going to be 0, which we can kind of see is follows from the symmetry that I imposed on my Lagrangian, that because my big phi had to be invariant under rescaling, that means that my potential is flat in the radial direction. So the excitations of that don't require any energy. And this is what's known as a Goldstone boson. And in general, when you have a spontaneous breaking of symmetry, you have Goldstone bosons corresponding to each of the symmetry directions. So that's just because of the flatness of the potential. I kind of zoom out and look in the original theory, it's obvious. But, you know, and then what I'm left with is this heavy scalar field phi. So there are 2 degrees of freedom. Yes?
What happens if your web is changing time, like with the real Higgs, the standard model Higgs?
Yes.
Do you have this temperature and your web is moving?
Yes.
So you need to take a derivative of that.
That's a great question. And you know, generally what, so I mean, it always depends on what limit you're in. So if you're in a limit where you're basically dealing with the evolution of the scalar field itself, then what you need to do is derive the equations of motion for phi. And as long as it's happening slowly enough and you only care about the minimum, you have to self-consistently solve those equations. But then of course, you have some changing background, so that can lead to particle production and other effect. So if you want to deal with this in a fully self-consistent quantum mechanical way, you have to accept that, you know, if I have some scalar field that's on, it's in some coherent state, and so it's in general quite complicated. Yeah. So you know, that is an active area of, you know, research. And, you know, in certain limits, it's going to look different how you treat it. Any questions? This was like the 2-minute version of Goldstone's theorem. So, yes.
Yeah, so you mentioned another unitary way to give masses is make them composite, right? The bosons, say, and then let them decay at high energies. So
yes.
Or it doesn't work, right, for the W and Z, right?
So that's a great question. Does it work or not? And I'd say before the discovery of the Higgs, maybe it did, right? I mean, there were people who wrote papers that were trying to say, what if the W and Z are composite? Then you don't expect a Higgs boson. You might see something very different, just like we don't see a Higgs boson associated with the Rho meson. Now that we've discovered a Higgs boson, then you need, you know, you can still have compositeness in that sector, but it looks pretty fundamental, so you need to have some, you know, mixing between the fundamental like scalar and the composite or something like this. So that's absolutely something that you could do, but discovering the Higgs boson has significantly narrowed the range of what theories could do that. Okay. Now, at long last, we will turn on our coupling to the to our photon. Okay. We're going to couple it to a massless photon. That's not what I want. Oh, here it is. Photon. So this photon has a gauge invariance associated with it. Okay, and so now we have to generalize the gauge transformation because it affects not only the photons. The photon behaves in the usual way. But the scalar field is also going to transform. It looks very similar to what we had before. Okay, but this gauge parameter is going to show up in the phase that we're shifting the field by. Okay, so it's no longer a global phase for all points in space. This lambda is a function of x. And this g is going to be the coupling between phi and a. And we often refer to this as a U1 gauge invariant. So U1 just means, you know, rephasing, multiplying by a complex phase, because I'm rotating the field by just a complex phase. Okay. If I were to just take this Lagrangian and perform this transformation on it, I would not get something that's invariant. Okay. And the reason is that when I take this derivative with respect to big phi, I'm going to pick up derivatives on both lambda as well as derivatives of big phi. And so if I just write down the same Lagrangian, it's not going to work. Okay. So what we have to do is basically change all of my du's to what we call covariant derivatives. And these are chosen, so this is called the covariant derivative. And these are chosen so that under a gauge transformation, this d mu acting on the phi turns into e to the ig lambda of x d mu. So in other words, it behaves as if this were a constant. So we can actually see that. Maybe I'll put this one up here. So if I take my d mu phi, did we used to have Hagoromo chalk at PI? I feel like maybe that's been removed in some cost-cutting measure. I'm used to Hagoromo chalk at work, so. All right. So under a gauge transformation, I shift the gauge field. D mu lambda. And then I also shift this. And basically what happens is that the derivative acting on this lambda is going to cancel with that term. And I'll spare you the algebra, although if you've never done this before, I really encourage you to do it. And I get this same thing back with a phase. So then if I have d mu phi star, this is going to give me back the same d mu phi, so again, under a gauge transformation, back the same d mu phi star, okay, times an e to the ig lambda and e to the minus ig lambda. These go to 1. And basically, my Lagrangian is invariant under this gauge transformation. Questions about, at least conceptually, even if you're not following all the steps of math, like why we have to do this, anything like that? Yes?
I remember that I think before Peter Higgs' paper, there was an issue with the Goldstone's theorem. And so my question is, if by getting here that the Goldstone boson, do we like ignore the Gaussian theorem, it doesn't incorporate it?
That's a great question. And what we're going to find is that because this scalar phi is interacting with the gauge field, that rather than getting a massless Goldstein boson, it's going to get eaten by the gauge field to turn into a longitudinal polarization. So you're right that this was a nice setup for a long time, but people are like, we don't really see massless bosons. Of course, the pions are kind of somewhat massless compared to the QCD scale. So, you know, there was some understanding of the role in that context. But yeah, it was like, well, this couldn't be responsible for giving mass to it, because, or for the, say, the SU2 gauge interactions, because we don't see massless bosons. But that's kind of the whole point. And we'll see in a second what happens with that. Okay. Yeah.
Can we still describe the theory as having a massless scalar and a vector boson?
In the high energy theory, yes. Yes, and we'll see that there's something called the Goldstone boson equivalence theorem that says that at high energy is basically the rearrangement that happens, everything kind of splits back into their pieces that you would expect of a massless theory, and that's what allows us to take a smooth high energy limit. So yes, that's exactly the point of all this, actually. So it's great foreshadowing. okay. We're almost out of time, so I'm just going to write one or two more things, and then I'll let you go, because I know everyone's very eager to get coffee. But we're basically going to do exactly the same thing that we did before. We picked the same potential for V of big phi. It still has a minimum, not at phi equals 0, so we still have to define this. So when I write out my Lagrangian, I'm basically going to get the kinetic terms for my two scalars. Okay, the same scalar potential that we had before for little phi. But then we're going to get these new terms, okay? Because of the fact that I now have this covariant derivative that has this, you know, a mu acting on it. Okay, so I'm going to get terms like gv a mu d mu pi 1 plus phi over v squared plus 1 half g squared v squared a mu
factor in front of the kinetic derivative pi change within one and the other.
Do the factor?
Because it's 1 plus pi squared there, and it's 1 plus pi.
Oh, yeah, sorry. That's a mistake on my, yeah. No, I think it should be on the outside. I think it should be on the outside. I think that might be a typo up there. I will check on that and provide a clarification. That's not really the part we're interested in, because this gives interactions purely within the scalar sector. But if we kind of parse all of the junk that's here, what we find is that this term, the leading piece, is a bunch of constants times d mu pi a mu. Okay. So if I were to write like a Feynman diagram associated with this, this looks like gauge boson turns into scalar. That's interesting, because it says that as the gauge boson is propagating, it's kind of flipping back and forth with this scalar degree of freedom. That's going to be the longitudinal polarization. So the Goldstone boson gets eaten. This term here, the leading term again, is constant times a mu a mu. This is a mass for the photon. And the mass of the photon is going to be ma squared is g squared v squared. So it's a portion of the gauge coupling as well as to this vacuum expectation value or classical value of the field. So this is set up. We're going to go on tomorrow to see how this applies to the fold theory. But we kind of get a sense of when you couple a complex scalar to a gauge field and have the scalar with a non-zero field value, you get this mixing term between the gauge field and the Goldstone boson, which eats it, gives you the extra polarization, and gives a mass to the gauge boson. So we'll leave it there. Cliff, you said the coffee's downstairs in the bistro?
Down at the bistro.
Okay. And then we're meeting back at 11 for the first LHC lecture. So thank you for being a great audience. We'll see you and the coffee.